I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
How many tractor trailers does it take to haul off about $1 billion in hundreds? Well, apparently three. According to the New York Times, as bombing began in Baghdad March 18th, around 4 in the morning, Saddam Hussein's youngest son, Qusay, loaded up the trucks outside Baghdad's central bank and made his getaway. For more on the international hunt for the Hussein family's billions, we turn now to Jamie Detmer, who's senior editor of Insight magazine. And welcome, Jamie.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, pleasure to have you. How much money, Jamie, did Saddam Hussein and his family have?
Well, estimates vary greatly, from $2 billion to $40 billion. We know that from the U.S. Treasury that they've identified more than $1 billion in previously unknown Iraqi accounts around the world, and the Bank of England has already seized about $640 million. Forbes magazine estimated Saddam's wealth had gone down in the last few years. They had his wealth at $2 billion. We also know, however, that between about 1997 and 2001, the Iraqi leadership was making anything from $6 to $9 billion on oil smuggling and on kickbacks for the Oil for Food program. Each barrel they received that was exported out under the UN auspices, they received 30 to 50 cents per barrel.
Let's assume for the moment that the Husseins are still alive. They're on the run. If indeed Qusay pulled up to the central bank in Baghdad and walked off with $1 billion in cash, what good would it be to him? How would he haul it around? In suitcases?
Well, there is the New York Times report suggests that these tractor trailers may have gone into Syria. There is some claim by U.S. intelligence that that was the case. And then once in Syria, of course, it could get into the international banking system. One theory that's being put around at the moment is that the Husseins, if they are alive, as many suppose they still are, could be using this money in preparation for some kind of organized resistance in Iraq against the U.S.-UK occupation. But then there's a lot of money probably outside, which is generally involving the Husseins' business interests around the world, which could, I suppose, continue to fund them to have a very enjoyable retirement.
Yeah. Now, if they are alive, and if there is money floating around, some of it in banks, some of it only accessible electronically, mm-hmm. couldn't they be tracked that way? I mean, can they go to an ATM and access their money? How does it work when you're on the run?
Tracked that way. It is incredibly complex, though, finding money. We do know from non-Iraqi bankers who worked, for example, for Saddam Hussein, that he had a very Byzantine complex empire of accounts and companies. We know that one bank account, for example, in the Bahamas, which was nicknamed the Satan Bank account, was fairly operational until about 2 years ago. That's according to Bank of England sources. What seems to have happened is that a lot of money was put into these offshore companies that were then controlled by businessmen, diplomats, expatriates, all loyal to Saddam. So it's not like you'll see the Saddam Hussein bank account in Nassau, Bahamas, or in Panama, or Liechtenstein, or in Switzerland. There will be different company names and different individual names as well who will be controlling that money at the behest of the Husseins. So it is very complex to find this kind of money. One further point on that, in the 1990s, there was a very big German operation to try to hunt down a few billion dollars of East German Communist Party and intelligence money that had left East Germany just before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Very little of that money has been found. They were able to track it through a dizzying array of bank accounts in the UK and in the US and in Paris, and then it kind of disappeared in the British Virgin Islands. There's some theory that some of the money went to Israel, but that money has not been recovered.
If they're on the run, they can access their money.
Via other people, yes.
Mm-hmm. What if they're not with us anymore, the Hussein family? How can the U.S. access their money?
Well, that's, again, a very complex problem because a lot of this money is going to be held in different jurisdictions who have different rules. For example, under the U.S. law during wartime, a U.S. president can seize the assets of the enemy power. But they can't just wander to other jurisdictions, let's say France, Switzerland, Germany, and demand that money is seized. The courts there are going to require that the money is linked specifically and directly to wrongdoing. and that can be a very complex matter in itself. It is likely that any money that is found outside the US, any accounts, any assets, will spend some time in the courts with people arguing about who actually owns that money.
Will the Iraqi people ever see any of this money?
I think they may see some. I'm kind of doubtful that the pot of gold will be found. And even if pots of gold are found, as I said, I think it's going to be ensnared for a considerable time in the Swiss courts, in the Bahama courts, in the Liechtenstein courts, etc.
Jamie Detmer, thanks very much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Jamie Detmer joined us. He's a senior editor for Insight magazine.
Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill are close to passing a bill that opponents say would prevent victims of gun crimes from suing gun makers, importers, or sellers. The Washington Post calls the bill a bipartisan retreat from gun control. The measure itself is officially called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. But some on Capitol Hill have dubbed it the Things You've Got to Do to Get Reelected Act. Joining us on the line are John Lowy. He's a lawyer with the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington. Hello, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also welcome Gary Mihalik. He's spokesman for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. They're based in Newtown, Connecticut. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much.
And Gary, I'm going to start with you. You both have very different views of this legislation, but tell me, Gary, do you even agree with the premise in the introduction that this bill would prevent victims of gun crimes from suing gun manufacturers?
It would protect innocent people. It would prevent those kinds of lawsuits we've seen filed in the last 4 years that are actually meant to harass and financially burden people who have done nothing wrong.
Well, let me ask you more straightforwardly. If, heaven forbid, I was the victim of a gun crime and I was injured by someone who had purchased the gun illegally from a gun shop, could I sue that gun shop?
The bill is very straightforward, and in 9 pages says explicitly that anyone who commits a criminal act, anyone who's negligent, or people that build defective products are not covered by this legislation. So if somebody breaks the law, they are both liable for criminal prosecution and also civil action.
John, do you agree with Gary's assessment of the bill?
No, I don't. I mean, this bill is an unprecedented attempt to give an industry immunity from civil liability, and it would throw many innocent victims out of court. Let me just tell you about some. Denise Johnson, who lost her husband, Conrad, in the sniper shootings.
In Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C., yes, that terrorized the country. What we found out is there was a grossly irresponsible gun dealer, Bullseye Gun Shop in Tacoma, Washington, that could not account for the Bushmaster assault rifle that was used by the snipers and could not account for over 200 other weapons in its inventory. I think everyone would agree that a gun dealer that can't even account for over 200 guns is acting irresponsible and is negligent. Now, they may not be engaging in criminal conduct, but it's negligent.
Well, and Gary, what about that? That is the case that people speak of. This gun shop, which, as John said, has lost track of over 200 of its assault rifles. First of all, some think that that should be a criminal offense, but if it's not, shouldn't they be sued?
Well, I'm hesitant to comment on that case because it's under investigation. The two of you have used the number of 200, and I've recently seen reported in the press that the number is now 78. I've also seen reported in the press that one of the people accused of being the sniper has admitted to shoplifting that firearm. So there are a great many facts yet to be determined in this case.
But, Gary,
let me say hypothetically that if a firearms dealer commits criminal acts, the firearms dealer is not covered by this legislation. If somebody is negligent, criminal, or builds or sells a defective product, they're not covered because this bill is designed, as it's titled, to protect lawful commerce.
That's simply not true. First of all, the dealer in the sniper case could go to prison for violating gun laws and still retain immunity from civil liability under this bill. And additionally, the civil justice system states that people can and should be held liable for negligent conduct, even if it's not criminal. And the bill is very carefully written to exempt gun manufacturers and dealers from liability in almost all cases, because even though it allows some product liability claims, it says those claims can only be allowed when the gun is used as intended by the manufacturer. Well, in almost every product liability case against a gun manufacturer, the gun is used, unfortunately, in a way that the manufacturer would prefer that it not be used, just as in most automobile product liability cases. The driver did something wrong. However, the manufacturer knew that it was likely that the driver would do something wrong and should have put in airbags or should have put in crash-resistant bumpers or something like that. Same thing in gun cases.
Gary, putting the interpretation of the bill aside, why does your industry need any protection from lawsuits at all? It would be the only one in America that would get this kind of immunity. Some would call it an affirmative action, if you will. Why does the gun industry need it?
I think it's because it's the only industry that is being attacked in this way. It's uniquely attacked for political reasons. I think the car analogy is a very good one. A few months back, there was a story about a woman who ran over her husband with an SUV. Is it right to sue the manufacturer of the SUV because that woman used the vehicle to kill her husband? I think that's the same kind of attack that we've had on the firearms industry. How on earth could it be the manufacturer's fault?
Yeah, that's not the SUV case has nothing to do with the actual cases that would be barred by this bill. The cases that would be barred by this bill don't say that a manufacturer or dealer should be liable simply because their gun was used in crime. It's because they did something wrong. The manufacturer didn't put in a safety device that would have prevented the 7-year-old Brandon Maxfield from becoming quadriplegic. So the idea of this suggestion that cases are brought simply because a manufacturer gun was used in crime is a complete red herring and has nothing to do with the actual cases brought by real people.
Gary, I'm going to give
thrown out of court by this bill.
One last question to you, Gary. The gun industry is a very wealthy industry. Does the gun industry really want to be in the position of being seen as robbing Americans of the right to sue, which seems like such a fundamental right?
Well, I would take exception to your characterization of the gun industry as being rich. It's not. It's run by mom-and-pop entrepreneurs to a large extent. There are some publicly traded companies in the industry, but I would not say that it's anything like the tobacco companies that some used as the inspiration for these lawsuits. This bill does not prevent anyone from filing a suit. It protects innocent people who have been wrongfully accused, their reputations tarnished, names dragged through their mud, and their wallets emptied by attorneys and politicians trying to accomplish something in the courts they couldn't get the legislature to do.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary Mihalik, spokesperson for the National Shooting Sports Foundation based in Newtown, Connecticut, and John Lowy, lawyer with the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. They're based in Washington, D.C.
Well, just ahead, a piece some listeners may find disturbing, cutting. A father speaks about his daughter's addiction to wounding herself.
And later in the program, John Malkovich on Being John Malkovich.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A teenaged girl sits alone in her bedroom. She's, say, 15 years old, does well in school, and is part of a loving family. And she's also terribly, terribly angry, sad, and self-destructive. She picks up a knife, or maybe it's a pin or a pair of scissors, and she drags the blade across her arm and blood begins to flow. This is not a suicide attempt, nor even a cry for help. So what is it? Well, by some estimates, there are 2 to 3 million Americans who cut or otherwise injure themselves. Most are young women, like the imagined teenager we just used as an example. But perhaps a quarter are men. We're joined now by a man named Eric, whose daughter has cut herself. Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Eric, why?
Well, for my daughter, she was dealing with a lot of issues from the death of her mother, from breast cancer, to going to a new school, to being a child of color in a primarily white environment. And we took her to a therapist. Now, the therapist became very concerned about her and wanted to institutionalize her. And much as I was concerned about that, I allowed myself to be talked into it. And while she was in a teenage psychiatric facility for a week, she learned cutting there from the other girls who were there. And when she came out, she was not only still depressed about the issues that she was facing, she had a new issue, and that was cutting.
Did she ever explain to you, her obviously loving father, what this did for her?
She did. We had a very close relationship, and one of the blessings was that she kept me informed. I had not been aware of the dynamics of cutting before. When you cut yourself very slowly, it doesn't hurt the way a fast cut hurts. It seems to release a body opiate that makes you feel very content, and it's a way of self-medicating yourself. And therefore, it's not only seductive in the sense that they're doing something to themselves, which gives them a feeling of control. It's also addictive.
Eric, stay with us, please. We're going to turn now in the studio here to our regular health columnist, Judy Foreman, who's been listening to all this and who has looked into the subject of cutting. Judy, welcome.
Thank you.
Judy, what does medical science tell us about cutting?
Well, it's as fascinating as it is horrifying. It does seem to release endorphins, these natural opiate blockers in the body, or the natural opiates, rather. But it also seems to induce a kind of pain, which for some cutters is also the point, because if you feel really numb and dead inside and you can cut yourself and see the blood and feel it in your arm or wherever you're cutting, it gives you a sense of your own physicality, your own boundaries. And if you're feeling dead and numb inside, even that pain is better than the nothingness.
Now, does it tend to be associated with other things? Does it lead to drugs? Does it lead to suicides?
Apparently, it does not lead to suicide, except in rare cases where it's an accidentally overly deep cut. But it is highly associated with anorexia and bulimia. It's usually in the direction that you start out with the anorexia and often develop into a cutter. And it's not quite clear why this happens.
Before we go back to Eric, can cutting be stopped? How do you stop it?
Yes. One of the things that doctors do is they give you a drug called naltrexone or naloxone, which blocks the body's response to opiates. So in other words, you're self-medicating by cutting. When you take this drug, you don't get the high from cutting. But when you're taking away this behavior and the high, you've really got to support people because suddenly they don't have the crutch that they've been using to feel okay from time to time. So you have to have lots of resources, incredible amount of therapy and people around in the hospital to say, you know, talk about your feelings, put your feelings into words rather than cutting.
Eric, tell us about your daughter. How is she doing at this point?
Well, the cutting is behind her.
How did she get there?
It wasn't easy for her to stop. For a while, it became more secretive, something that she did on parts of her body that were not so readily identifiable. It took a while for working with a good therapist. In fact, we had to change therapists. But also, her understanding of herself and what this represented changed.
Eric, I was really intrigued by the fact that your daughter was not cutting till she was institutionalized, and then she picked up cutting from the other girls. There apparently is a huge element of contagion in this, and I gather, I'm sure you know more about this than I do, but that there are websites and kind of almost a belief system among some young girls that cutting is okay. It's maybe seen as cool, and it's sort of a just another alternative form of self-expression. What do you think of that?
Well, she did, in fact, share it with some of her friends. And I felt the enormous guilt of this plague that I had brought into the families of people that I knew and cared about. And it increased my sense of responsibility to help her and to help others get over this. The self-medicating effect, finding kind of an inner tranquility, was what was really disturbing. And I tried to see if there were other ways for her to achieve those feelings by meditation and by finding greater tranquility and sense of control over her life. It didn't work at first, but we stuck by it, including giving her much more control over her life than I might otherwise have, and to maintain, keep open the lines of communications where she would honestly tell me what was going on. And once she kicked it, she took a real responsibility for influencing other girls to get off of it. Quite often when she hears of somebody cutting, she will take the initiative to call them and talk to them about how dangerous this is and where the path leads, and to quit earlier rather than later.
Eric, thank you very much.
I thank you.
Any final thoughts, Judy Foreman?
I think she's very lucky to have a father like him, and it can be very difficult for parents to, when the daughter stops cutting and starts expressing her feelings verbally, that can be tough for parents to take, because often there's a lot of anger, a lot of distress, and the parent has to kind of sit tight and hold on to those feelings.
Judy Foreman, thank you for bringing this really extraordinary syndrome to our attention.
Thank you.
Judy Foreman is our regular health columnist. To read her column about cutting, visit our website, here-now.org.
What a wonderful father. Well, tomorrow on Here Now, the what-ifs of history explored in the novel Last Stop Vienna. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an Oklahoma high school principal says he's upset about the lack of education funding from Washington, and the Education Department's deputy secretary responds.
It's not really about whether administrators are necessarily happy if they might have to substitute teach a class here or there. The bottom line is making sure that the students have a quality education.
And actor John Malkovich on being himself and why he's directing The Dancer Upstairs and not starring in it.
I always say that would sort of force my least favorite actor to work with my least favorite director.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Democrats are unveiling their stimulus package today, including billions of dollars in tax cuts and a 50% tax credit for small businesses. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says the plan would restore benefits for 4 million American workers,
including people who have exhausted their benefits and have been unable to find new jobs. workers whose benefits will run out at the end of this month, and workers who have been paying into the unemployment insurance program but are unable now to receive benefits.
The plan also includes $40 billion for state and local aid. President Bush continues his push for new tax cuts, saying the move would stimulate the economy and create jobs. In a speech today, Bush claimed both Republicans and Democrats recognize the importance of tax cuts.
That's important, that both houses understand that when somebody keeps more money, they're likely to demand a good or a service when they have more of their own money to spend.
The House has approved a $550 billion cut, but Bush wants a tax cut of $750 billion. President Bush's top budget advisor is quitting. According to White House officials, Mitch Daniels, head of the Office of Management and Budget, tendered a letter of resignation to the president this morning. He is expected to run for governor in Indiana. Daniels' departure comes just as the administration faces a tough effort to get Congress to approve a new round of tax cuts. U.S. Treasury Department officials say the son of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein took nearly $1 billion out of Iraq's central bank. Authorities say Hussein ordered the money shortly before U.S. bombs began to fall and sent his son along with three tractor trailers to haul it away. There is no word yet on where the money was taken, though some officials say much of the cash may have been discovered already in one of Saddam's palaces last month. Tensions appear to be easing between nuclear neighbors Pakistan and India. Pakistan has restored transportation links with India, announced full diplomatic ties, and is calling for efforts to end the dispute over the Kashmir region. Leaders of India and Pakistan made contact last week for the first time in 2 years. On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 70 points at 8602. The Nasdaq is ahead 19 at 1523, and the S&P 500 is up 9. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Many state governments across the country are dealing with huge budget deficits, revenues down due to the flat economy and sagging stock market. And so spending must be forced down, too. Consider some of these cost-saving measures school districts have been forced into. In Portland, Oregon, teachers working 10 days without pay. Competency tests on hold in Utah's Weber School District. In Boston, the shutdown of 5 schools and an increase in class sizes. The school district in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has had to make do with less, too. They can't pay for substitute teachers anymore. Stephen Mayfield is principal of the Edison Preparatory School in Tulsa. And, Principal Mayfield, what do you do when a teacher calls in sick?
Well, we really have two options left to us. Dr. Sawyer here in Tulsa initiated a program of volunteer subs throughout the city who would volunteer their time 1 day or 2 days a month to the district. If that's not the case, then I've set up 4 teams here within the building of office staff, counselors, deans, myself, my secretary, on down the line, and one of those teams will cover the teacher.
The principal has to work as a substitute.
Absolutely.
How do you feel about that?
Well, it cuts into everybody's time, from the registrar to my secretary to everybody. And it's just something that has to be done. You cannot leave children unattended, obviously.
Why don't you have enough money?
Well, this is nationwide. I think it's something like $10 or $12 billion that schools or state budgets are in the hole. Oklahoma is $677 million short this year. In our district, Tulsa, within the last 2 years, has lost $17 million. And this year, we've lost, $12.3 million. So this is really a nightmare. when you look at schools across the nation, you know, when 28% of your household have children in public schools, the tax base isn't there. People are not going to vote for those types of revenues to keep those schools going because they don't have a vested interest, not knowing, really, that that is the vested interest of any nation, is its young people. Mm.
Besides the problem with substitutes, what other cuts have you had to make?
Well, like I said, just personnel. I'm going to lose teachers, which means I will lose programs here. I've lost a photography class. I've lost a tech ed class. I'm losing a science teacher. I'm losing two art programs. So those really impact the type of offerings we have available to our students. And also, you know, Tulsa has almost about 4,500 employees, and none of those employees received any type of raise last year or this year. I know that's a moot point, but it's just another ramification when the budget goes south.
What about next year?
It looks more bleak starting in July.
More bleak?
More bleak. Everything, when they just wrapped up the education budget 2 weeks ago, that was all based on speculative in terms of the revenue that the state would receive. That could change in August, and it could be much worse. But they are expecting it not to be as good, so to speak, as it was this year. So I look for even more drastic cuts as we go into fall.
Thank you, Principal.
Thank you.
We turn now to Bill Hansen, the Deputy Secretary at the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. Hello, Secretary Hansen.
Hello, Bill.
Well, Secretary, you just heard Principal Stephen Mayfield in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Substitutes having to work for free, teachers cut, courses cut. Is this the sort of thing you're hearing all over the country?
There are budget problems in numerous school districts around the country, and there's some tough times in many of the states, just like there is at the federal level right now. But I do think we need to keep in context a couple of things, that as a nation, we are spending $480 billion on K through 12 education this year, and in the aggregate, that has gone up about $20 or $25 billion each and every year since 1990.
Money doesn't seem to be resolving the problem, though, that extra $20 to $25 billion every year.
I think what has happened is actually in some of the good times, too, when we're investing and spending that more money each and every year, that many times school systems might be expanding their system and expanding their missions. And so when we do hit a tough time, it is tough to do a little bit of belt tightening, but I think, again, we got to keep the long run, just like folks that maybe look to the stock market do, where you've got to keep a view of the long run and to make sure that the tough times are not overwhelming to you and that you've got kind of a rainy day fund to put aside when you've had 10 good years in a row.
Uh-huh. Are you suggesting that perhaps some school districts overreached in the kind of go-go 90s?
You know, I think it's possible, but, you know, we have 16,000 school districts in this country, and, you know, obviously everybody has different needs and different priorities. So, but again, as a country, we have been investing more and more money in education, and what we really are hoping, though, is to make sure that the attention is turned to quality and the service that is being delivered to our students and achievement is what the focus is and not necessarily just the issue of resources.
How do you see the federal government's responsibility for a situation like Tulsa, where there aren't enough substitutes, there aren't enough teachers, and courses are being cut?
The lion's share of the federal dollars are dollars that really help level the playing field, either for educationally or economically disadvantaged children or for special education children that have either a physical or some type of a learning handicap. And it's important to note that education is primarily a state and local responsibility. Out of that $480 billion I mentioned earlier, about just 2 or 3 years ago, 93 cents on every dollar came from state and local and 7 from the federal government. The federal government has actually expanded dramatically in the last couple of years to where that percentage is now approaching 9% of what the federal share is and how much we're paying for education. So really at the federal level, we have the Department of Education has stepped up to the plate in the last couple of years and been providing huge increases to make sure that those special populations and the disadvantaged children are getting served.
But you don't feel it's the federal government's responsibility to fly to the aid of a school district like Tulsa, Oklahoma?
No, we have a limited role, again, and that is to help the most educationally economically disadvantaged out, but it's also to promote education reform, and that's what the No Child Left Behind law has been all about, is to really promote education reforms around the country.
You know, Secretary, there's a school of thought out there that the No Child Left Behind law is part of the problem, that it may be putting too much pressure on schools.
We really don't see it that way. The No Child Left Behind law is actually a pretty simple law when you get right down to it, is to ensure that we have a highly qualified teacher in every classroom, that we have more choices and options for parents in the public school arena, and that we have additional resources to pay for those initiatives, as well as to make sure that we have annual testing in grades 3 through 8 in math and science available to us, to make sure that we're able to diagnose if children are learning or not.
Secretary, you're considered something of the budget guru at the Department of Education. What would your advice be to Principal Stephen Mayfield? He's looking for an even worse year economically next fiscal year.
Well, I think has captured some of it right. People need to be innovative and looking for solutions, and it's not really about whether administrators are necessarily happy if they might have to substitute teach a class here or there. The bottom line is making sure that the students have a quality education at their schoolhouse door.
Secretary Bill Hansen, thanks very much for joining us.
Bill, thank you, sir.
Deputy Secretary Bill Hansen is at the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
Still to come, director John Malkovich on his new film, Revolutionary Movements, and why people find him interesting.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Lysistrata, Leaves of Grass, these are just a few of the books that have ruffled feathers when they appear on school reading lists. But last year, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill officials reached the pinnacle of book list protest when they made Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations by Michael A. Sells, required reading. Well, we wanted to see what the school had selected this year. So joining us on the line from UNC Chapel Hill is Cynthia Wolf Johnson. She runs the university's reading program. Hello, Dr. Wolf Johnson.
Good afternoon.
So what have you picked this year?
We have selected Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich.
Well, this is the story of Barbara Ehrenreich's sort of research into the world of $7 an hour jobs. Some listeners are familiar with it. Tell us more about the book.
The book is really a journalistic perspective of the author's experience in living a low-paying series of jobs. She has taken some time to quit her own profession as a middle-class individual, sold her house, sold her car, and gone on to live minimum-wage jobs, whether they are serving as a waitress or a maid, working in discount stores, to give people an understanding of the experience of what it is like to live on a minimum wage.
It's pretty damning of the world of minimum wage. Doesn't she have to work several jobs just to make it?
She does, indeed. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, especially after last year's real brouhaha over your pick, is this considered a more conservative, you know, one that might not bring as much controversy?
I think that would really depend upon an individual's individual's evaluation or perspective on that.
Why would it be controversial?
Well, some may view the book as a little bit on the liberal side, as opposed to the more middle of the road, and some may be concerned about what it says about our economic situation. Nonetheless, it is a portrayal of what life is like for people who live on a minimum wage, and as we all know, there are unfortunately all too many people in our society at that point.
And your students, many might be about to graduate into a world where unemployment is at a high.
That's most definitely the case. And so that certainly would be intriguing in understanding what the world is like for lots of people. Because, I mean, certainly we hope that our college graduates will receive more than minimum wage. But our society is always an uncertainty in terms of what the economics will bring us.
What kinds of changes, if any, did you see in your students after reading last year's book, The Quran?
What we found last year, like previous years, was that students were pleased to learn about something that they didn't already know about. They learned, some talked about learning about a culture and a religion they previously knew nothing about, that the reading gave them an opportunity to form their own opinions about Islam or to really reexamine their own faith and think more about what that means to them.
That's funny because they live so in the shadows, they may have that same reaction reading about the very poor and those, you know, working $7 an hour jobs. It may be as foreign a concept.
That's very true. And that's, you know, that's part of the purpose of our program, is really to expose students to things that are societal issues, yet things that perhaps they haven't really given a lot of thought to, been expected to read it.
Well, Dr. Wolf-Johnson, thank you.
You are very welcome.
Cynthia Wolf-Johnson runs the reading program at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
John Malkovich is a fascinating, sometimes unsettling actor. You wonder, what are his characters thinking? So much so that in the film Being John Malkovich, characters literally climb inside his head to try to read his mind. Well, now actor John Malkovich has directed his first film, and fans will finally get to see through his eyes. The film is called The Dancer Upstairs. It's based on a novel by Nicholas Shakespeare and loosely based on Peru's Shining Path or Sendero Luminoso revolutionary movement. The film stars Javier Bardem as Agustin Rejas, a lawyer turned police detective, tracking a revolutionary wreaking havoc in an unnamed Latin American country. But early on in the film, Agustin Rejas is still a lowly border guard who unknowingly meets the future revolutionary leader Ezequiel at a customs check.
You were a lawyer before.
That's right.
Lawyers, they're the worst. Bent. But you'll never catch them. Why do you want to be a lawyer?
I don't think I did want to be a lawyer.
Well, what did you want to be?
I wanted to be a gold farmer. Like my father.
So I didn't do. What stopped you?
I like a coffee farm.
What happened to your father's?
The military seized it.
Do you have a feeling about that? Or are you the Gary Cooper type?
Yes, I do have a feeling about that. But perhaps I am the Gary Cooper type.
A scene from the film The Dancer Upstairs, and director John Malkovich joins us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We hear some foreshadowing of the revolution to come. You know, the fellow who can't be a coffee farmer because the military took his coffee farm.
Yes.
And then the revolution does come. How do you think you did with your first directorial?
Well, I like the film a lot. I mean, it is the first feature-length film I've directed, but I've directed, I don't know, probably 50 plays, which is to say I've probably directed four or five times more things than the most prolific directors working.
Right.
And I also, strange enough, wrote and directed three fashion films. And I've made, I think, about 50 or 60 films as an actor. So For me, it wasn't a huge switch or some huge jump into the unknown, really.
I don't find it at all unusual that you did fashion films, because there's quite a look to this film. How are you trying to paint this film?
Well, it seems to me it's very odd, having spent a lifetime working with film directors, many of whom are always incredibly obsessed with an image, which has always sort of shown me either A, that's all they can do, or B, they think that's what a movie is, when really it really isn't at all. The films that I remember or that I think are great, that's actually a minor part of them.
And I'm guessing that the part that is the major is the story, which in this case, yeah, appealed to you in real life first. Tell us about that.
In the early 80s here, when they really started covering a little bit of Sendero Luminoso here in the States, I started reading about it and was interested, and I've always been interested in these incredibly murderous political, religious, tribal, national movements that murder people often en masse and then have the great ability to pretend it's for their cause. And no matter how many corpses, it's always okay because they have a cause. So those so-called movements, wherever they be, whoever runs them, whatever their stated intent is, had also really interested me.
Your story is about the pull of the people who might be attracted to the revolution, it would seem. I mean, Bardem has said the movie is about the journey of one man's soul. He, his character, is torn between his family and the somewhat vacuous social standing that they have, and what appears to be the earthiness in the pull of his daughter's ballet teacher. Let's first hear a scene where you can feel that pull.
Okay.
Do you only teach or do you still dance?
Well, just recently I started working on movies. I have an idea, but I still don't know.
What was it about?
Oh, something to do with the merger of that theatrical group, you know? But...
For what?
It's unlucky to talk about work in progress. Now, tell me about you. I know that you're a father, husband, and lawyer, and... Well, that's...
Well, yes, I'm a father and a husband, but I'm no longer a lawyer.
What do you do now?
I'm trying to find a more honest way of practicing the law.
Now, we don't want to give the ending away at all. I want people to see it the way I got to see it without knowing anything about this. But just say everything's not what it seems.
Yes.
That scene. And I guess the question is, how close to the abyss does he come? And the abyss in that scene is of an extramarital affair, but there's another abyss. And what is his, I guess, internal domestic revolution also say to us about people who get pulled to revolution?
Well, it's pretty understandable, the pull, because the sharing of power, the sharing of wealth, the possibility of having a voice in their governments was an option really not open to them. And so, in this case, a sort of Marxist ideology obviously promised them a better life. But that revolution also, for instance, in Peru, also had sort of almost mythological overtones.
Yes, and to round it out, the point is that that extramarital affair often has that mythological, you know, promise as well.
It's a way to save yourself. Right. I mean, let's say it can have that element to it.
Well, we don't want to give away the ending. So those of you who have studied the Sendero Luminoso might guess it in advance. But for the rest, we're not going to rob you of that moment. Couple questions for you. First of all, the movie almost didn't get made because studios wanted you to star in it, which you didn't do. But you did a cameo and then cut it out.
Actually, that's not true. I didn't do
it. Take it out of the press release.
Yeah, I know it's in the press release. In one shot of the film, which is not in the film, I was the sort of 800th extra from the left, but
why
never made the film.
Why, especially when early on there was so much pressure? People would love to see you. And I can think of, you could play the revolutionary. I mean, why not?
Yeah. Oh, it just wouldn't interest me to direct a film that I acted in. I always say that would sort of force my least favorite actor to work with my least favorite director. And also force me to watch myself in editing for a year or so. And that just, the thought of that really gives me shivers, makes me nauseous.
You have directed before and you've been directed, so you know whether or not this is true. But at a certain point, I found myself watching the screen and the whole ensemble was up there. And I found myself thinking, wow, everybody's being sort of John Malkovich-y. Did you see people sort of picking up on you?
I didn't, but I wouldn't be super aware of that. I mean, if it seemed like that, I think probably that has more to do with the tone of the film. And often when you see actors, I mean, my main note would be, yes, that's very good. It's very nice. Stop worrying about the English and do everything you're doing, but don't show it. Just think it.
Well, we're back where we started, which is watching John Malkovich is saying to yourself, what is he thinking?
Yes.
One very last question. Do you have an answer for why people are so fascinated with you? I mean, a whole film about people trying to get inside your mind and...
You know, it's funny. It's a very good question. But I'm so poorly placed to answer it. I hold no fascination for myself whatsoever. And I never did. I have no idea.
Well, thank you for coming in anyway.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Director and actor John Malkovich. His new film is called The Dancer Upstairs. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.